Welcome to the Triangle Radio Reading Service and Sports Illustrated Kids. I'm Dick Hayden. I'm filling in for your regular reader, John Ivy. Over the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Sports Illustrated Kids. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Now, we're going to have to be a little interesting in how we go about our program during the month of February, because as you may recall, Sports Illustrated Kids put out a January-February edition. That means there's no specific edition for February. And we've used up everything from that magazine and thrown in a few things from Boys Life. Well, we did a little more research, and we found some articles online. They're actually all by kid reporters. So they're coming definitely from your perspective for you. So let's see what we can come up with here. Now, some of these, in fact, we're going to have first two are going to be items that have already occurred. But it's kind of interesting to look at and see what happens when we think something's going to go a certain way. We find out it goes a little bit different way. This one, however, is about the Pro Bowl in football, which is already completed, but it talks about, as the title implies, NFL stars put rivalries behind for fun at the Pro Bowl. And the kid reporter is Michael Nichols. Last Sunday, and that was the Sunday that the game happened, not this last Sunday, but the last Sunday before January 30th. The NFL's best players from the AFC and the NFC collided in Orlando for the Pro Bowl. For the third straight year, the game was played at the Camping World Stadium in downtown Orlando, Florida, and in close proximity to the Disney World Parks, which allowed for all sorts of special events in the week leading up to the Pro Bowl. In the week preceding the Pro Bowl, the players go through practices and compete in special events like the Pro Bowl Skills Showdown at the ESPN Wide World of Sports. In the Pro Bowl Skills Showdown, the players compete against the opposing conference in a series of competitions such as precision passing, the gridiron gauntlet, best hands challenge, the 40-yard splash, and the epic pro dodgeball to decide the winner of the Pro Bowl Skills Showdown. This year's special contest was won by the NFC. In their practices, the teams run through drills and try to bond as a group, which can sometimes be interesting as these new teammates can often be regular season rivals. Players admit that playing against their rivals can make it interesting, but that sometimes friendships develop. It's a little weird, I'm not going to lie, Eagles safety Malcolm Jenkins said, especially because the entire Cowboys staff are the coaches, and I have to wear all this blue, and it's making my skin itch. But these guys are the best of the best at what they do. Oliver Vernon of the Giants added, "Yeah, it's great to see the division players and the rivals. You might have a little bit of animosity towards them, but it's all good fun. I've been warming up to DeMarcus Lawrence of the Cowboys. It's cool that we play the same position. He's on our rival team, but he's a good character guy." Teddy Bruschi, a former Pro Bowler for the Patriots who was covering the event for ESPN, explained that it was a little different when he played. "When I went to the Pro Bowl, the coaching staff was the loser of the AFC Championship game, which was the Pittsburgh Steelers. So it was hard to say, 'Hey, guys,' after we won the Super Bowl, and it was awkward at first, but that all goes away after the first day or so." Calais Campbell of the Jaguars probably summed up best the feeling of most players, saying, "Football is like a fraternity. You compete against guys and emotions are flying high, but at the end of the day, you understand their work ethic and you really get to know the guys." The Pro Bowl also allowed the players to reflect on lessons they've learned along the way that helped them reach this level of success. Some, like Vernon, talked about his family. "My dad led by example," Vernon said. "I saw him go to work every day. I tried to do the same thing as my dad and be tough." Victor Cruz, the former New York Giants Pro Bowler on site with ESPN, said that my mom always told me to finish what I start. No matter the ups and downs, always finish what you start. Ultimately, the game took place on a rainy Sunday at the Camping World Stadium, with the AFC jumping out to a halftime lead of 17-0 and holding on to win 26-7. Patrick Mahomes of Kansas City was named the offensive MVP of the game, while Jet safety Jamal Adams was named the defensive MVP. Despite the gloomy game day weather, it was a great week in Orlando, celebrating the end of another successful NFL season. Well, our next one, this is really interesting. Carlo Velandi wrote this one on January the 29th. He's our kid reporter. And this is why the LA Rams will still win Super Bowl 53. And as you probably know, they didn't. But here's what Carlo found out and why he wrote the article. The Los Angeles Rams are one step away from completing their championship mission. In May 2018, I wrote that the Rams would win Super Bowl 53. Despite facing a team with more Super Bowl experience, I still believe they will bring the Lombardi Trophy to the City of Angels for the first time since the Raiders did it in 1984. The Rams boast a star-studded team, which was only enhanced as a diamond in the rough through C.J. Anderson, who bounced from the Broncos to the Panthers and finally to L.A. in December. With the Rams, he has been stellar, racking up 422 yards and 4 touchdowns in 3 games. Not only is he making his case as a star of the offense, his role is even more important because it lightens the workload of Todd Gurley, allowing the feature back to shine. The Patriots' defense thrived at the point of attack this season, both rushing and hitting the quarterback. But how can a team counter that success? By utilizing the best offense in the line in the league. The Rams' front five started off on fire and was in a rut toward the end of the regular season, but has delivered big time for the run game so far in the playoffs. That line has also kept Jared Goff on the ground, only allowing 2 sacks so far this postseason. Goff had a Pro Bowl regular season, but recently he has surpassed even his own high standards. Goff's decision-making under pressure in the playoffs has been a veteran quarterback style. He undoubtedly will continue to take shots on the successful play-action game with deep throws to Brandon Cooks, who averages 15.1 yards per catch this season. But also expect to see Goff take advantage of the Todd Gurley versus Dante Hightower matchup. If Gurley gets matched up against slow-moving Hightower, as is expected, the Rams' stud running back will get opportunities in open field. Although the Rams are boasting a talented offense, remember the old adage, defense wins championships. No team has a better defense player than Aaron Donald. As a defensive tackle, he had 20.5 sacks in the regular season, an all-time NFL record for the position. Donald has been dominant in turnover force, with 4 forced fumbles and many interceptions caused after knocking the quarterback to the ground. And if there is a weakness for the Pats to exploit, it is in the Rams' secondary, which has not met expectations. But cornerback Aqib Talib returned to the lineup from an injury a few weeks ago, and he's already settling into McVay's defense and making a difference. Remember, too, that Talib has playoff experience as a former Patriot and a former Bronco. Bill Belichick is a legendary coach, but McVay has a strong bond with this team. From my first-hand experience watching McVay at practice, his players treat him more like a highly respected team captain. The Los Angeles Rams' stellar offense, disruptive defense, and winning mentality will lead the team to host the Super Bowl 53 Lombardi Trophy very high on this Sunday. Well, as we know, that didn't happen, but writers write in advance, and I think, as they sometimes say, lament thereafter. Our next kid reporter is Christopher John, and he wrote this article on January the 23rd. It's called New Jersey Devils Kids Day, featured young reporters and scorers. It was a day when the New Jersey Devils wanted to celebrate their youngest fans, so it was fitting that their young players would use the opportunity to shine. Supported by the shutout effort of 22-year-old rookie goaltender Mackenzie Blackwood and a shorthanded game-winning goal for 21-year-old Pavel Zacha, the Devils would go on to beat the Carolina Hurricanes in an afternoon game on December the 29th, 2-0. The day was dubbed Kids Day at the Prudential Center, and it featured a number of activities designed to entertain young fans. The Devils invited an SI Kids reporter to join the fun. "For us, it's important to have young fans," said head coach John Hines. "It's important to be able to build a base when they are really young, to like our team, and then they become attached to our players and attached to the Jet Devils hockey. Hopefully, we play well enough that we get fans for life." The Devils certainly created chances for fans to get involved, including the Little Devils Zone, which is a free and available feature at every home game. Here, kids are able to play games that help teach hockey basics, like passing the puck and shooting on net. At a healthy hat trick assembly, the team mascot, the NJ Devil, ran the kids through fitness exercises, including push-ups, sit-ups, and jumping rope. These activities are meant to teach the importance of staying fit and healthy. Many elements of the game featured kids, from the singer of the national anthem to the guest radio color analyst during the second period. And it was me. Not me, but Christopher John. While helping play-by-play veteran Mike Laughlin and longtime analyst and former Devils goalie Chico Reisch with the calling action, I got to experience firsthand the hard work and preparation it takes to do the job well. During stoppages in play, both broadcasters asked me my thoughts on players like Blackwood, who is playing in only his third NHL start. He had come off a great game two nights before against the Boston Bruins, where he stopped 40 of 42 shots for a win. Reisch said that being a successful radio broadcaster is about being able to provide specific descriptions about the play that is going on and being able to provide information that listeners will find interesting. They spend a lot of time doing their own research before every game. In addition to helping out with the radio broadcast, I got to do a segment with Devils correspondent Amanda Stein. Together, we did a feature for the pregame. The experience was made possible by Kayla McLaughlin, a member of the Devils organization, who works in media relations. She helped me navigate the locker room and the media room for both the pregame and postgame press conferences. Kids Day not only showed young fans all of the ways they can have fun before and during the game, but also highlighted some of the team's best young stars. Coach Hines says he is encouraged by what the future holds for the team. He feels that their young prospects will continue to produce and shine for the fans of New Jersey for a very long time. Our next kid reporter is Carlo Valandi. He wrote this article in September, and it's about the new Auburn University AD, athletic director, Alan Green. And it's titled, "New Auburn AD Alan Green Emphasizes the Student-Athlete Experience." The office of the new Auburn University athletics director, Alan Green, overlooks the 87,451-seat Jordan-Hare Football Stadium. The facility does right by football. That's important, as the Southeastern Conference is nothing if not football crazy. The success of football is very important to us, Green said, because we utilize the success of football to help support all our other student athletes. Green is hoping his athletes get more than titles and trophies. He's bringing a new focus to Auburn, the student-athlete experience. Green wants students to work hard on their academics, and after that, their athletics. Could that jeopardize on-field success? Well, I think focusing on the student-athlete experience and winning work really work well together, Green said. Winning is the outcome. Green is certain that his student-athlete emphasis will help Auburn reach a level of success that the university has never had. While football is critical to Auburn, the Tigers went 7-1 in the SEC last season, Auburn has earned a national championships across all sports. Auburn Athletics seemed to be on the right track, yet quickly after he was hired, Green fired 5 administrators from his department. That's a big change for a winning department. Sometimes you have to make changes that are in the best interest of the organization, Green said. Full of surprises, Green asserts what those best interests are with his 3 overarching principles. His first goal is to make sure students are as dedicated to their studies as they are to their athletic pursuits. Secondly, he wants to win championships. And finally, he wants to help young people develop into being productive members of society. But how can students and coaches really achieve academic goals when aiming for athletic championships? Green, who expects his coaches to stay in touch with the athletes' academic advisors, admits it's a challenge. It's very hard for my coaches and our athletes to focus on academics and athletics, Green said. But that's what makes student athletes and intercollegiate athletes unique. Just as Green's new idea of the student athlete experience at Auburn may be unique, Green's hiring broke new ground. He is the 3rd African-American athletic director in the Southeastern Conference and the very first at Auburn University. In 2018, I wish my skin color was not an issue, Green said. However, it is a tremendous honor to be in the role that I am and at a place that the rest of the country traditionally sees as not progressive. Whether or not Green's ideas deliver championships, it will likely be a good time to play sports at Auburn University. And if Green's student-athlete experiment is successful, it could spark a trend for college athletics everywhere. Well, let's move on at this point to what is sometimes called basketball and other times called round ball. A kid reporter, Jaisal Kalapattapu, wrote this following article titled, "Which Teams Are Surprising Us This NBA Season?" 2 months into the NBA season, we are beginning to see which teams are playoff contenders, which are still in the hunt to make the postseason, and which are simply struggling to win games. Here are 4 teams that have surprised me with their performance so far. So let's see what Jaisal has in mind. The Los Angeles Clippers. The Clippers were clearly in a rebuilding mode last year. They traded perennial all-star point guard Chris Paul to Houston before taking the 2017-18 season. Traded superstar power forward Blake Griffin to Detroit during the season. And then let center DeAndre Jordan go to Dallas in free agency this past offseason. They traded their 2 2018 first-round draft picks to get Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. Traded Austin Rivers for Marcin Gortat. and really didn't make a lot of other moves to bolster their roster. LA's plan seemed to be to tank this year, get one of the top players in the 19 draft, and possibly get a superstar using cap space in the offseason, and then jump back into contention for the 2019-2020 season. What no one counted on was Tobias Harris. He was one of the key pieces in the Griffin trade and was considered a promising young big man who could become an elite scorer someday. That someday came sooner than expected. He's currently averaging 21.5 points and 8.2 rebounds per game, and he is shooting 51.3% from the floor and 40.3% from beyond the three-point line. With players such as Lou Williams and Danilo Gallinari playing well too, the Clippers have a record of 17-13 and are tied for fifth in the West. Not bad for a team that got rid of its big three less than a year ago. The Houston Rockets. Not all surprises are good, and the Rockets have not been good this season. Houston finished 65-17 last year and fell one game short of toppling the eventual champion Warriors in the Western Conference Finals. The Rockets were supposed to pick up right where they left off and be at the top of the West. During the offseason, they lost Trevor Ariza to the Suns and Luke Mapamute to the Clippers, but signed Carmelo Anthony, one of the best scorers of all time. Things seemed to be going well until the regular season began. What people underestimated was the value of Ariza. While he averaged only 11.7 points and 3.9 rebounds last year, he was the Rockets' best wing defender and would guard and somewhat contain guys such as Kevin Durant, LeBron James, Giannis Antetokounmpo, and other dominant wing players. When he left, the Rockets' defensive rating went from 7th to 27th in the league. Anthony did not help them much and was cut after a few games. The Rockets are 14-14, so there is still hope for them to turn it around. But they'll need to play better defense down the stretch. Next up, the Denver Nuggets. The Nuggets were not particularly terrible last season, finishing 46-36, and in ninth place in a tough Western Conference. This season, the expectation was that Nikola Jokic would lead them to a 6th, 7th, or 8th seed in the playoffs. However, that is not what is happening. The Nuggets are currently first in the West, ahead of teams such as the Warriors, Rockets, and Thunder. Behind Jokic's 17.7 points, 9.9 boards, and 7.5 assists, his team is currently 20-9. Perhaps the craziest part of the Nuggets season is that they only have one former All-Star on their team, Paul Millsap, and he's already 33 years old. Denver is facing teams with 2, 3, even 4 All-Stars and still beating them. Something else that makes this even weirder is that the Nuggets really did not make many off-season moves. They signed point guard Isaiah Thomas and drafted Michael Porter Jr., 14th in the 2018 draft. But neither one of them has played this year. The Nuggets have simply progressed from last year. While it is too early to tell if their production will last, the Nuggets are playing like contenders right now. And the final one on the list happens to be the Washington Wizards. The Wizards have been an interesting franchise to watch over the last few years. They have two All-Star players in John Wall and Bradley Beal, but management has failed to surround them with complementary players. Nevertheless, Washington made the playoffs the past few seasons, sliding in as the eighth seed last year after finishing with a 46-36 record. The Wizards even took the top-seeded Raptors to six games, so people expected them to make some moves and contend this year. Washington traded Gortat to the Clippers for Rivers and signed Dwight Howard and Jeff Green. And it looked like the team might actually have a solid season. But this has not been the case. Washington has started off the season with a dismal 12-18 record. And there are rumors about the team trading away Wall or Beal. It's hard to pinpoint where the Wizards went wrong, but their defense has just been lacking overall. Even after adding a former Defense Player of the Year in Howard, and adding another guy who was a solid guard defender in Rivers, Washington is still 28th in defensive rating, only ahead of the Knicks and the Cavs. Luckily for the Wizards, they're in the weaker Eastern Conference, and right now, they are only 2.5 games back of the 8th place Magic. As we move in toward the end of our program, let's do take a look at a couple of things from Boy's Life that I found that might be of interest to you. One is Kentucky girl is world champion, Ashton Grace, age 12, from Hopkinsville, Kentucky. And she made headlines by winning the 2018 local Super Stock World Championship of the All-American Soapbox Derby in Akron, Ohio. She started racing when she was 7 because her church had a couple of extra soapbox cars and asked if she wanted to use one. Her championship winnings were a trophy and a gold ring, a world champion jacket, and perhaps best of all, a $3,000 scholarship. And here we have Chase Holt, who's age 17, from Ballston Spa, New York. Happens to be an Eagle Scout. He made some headlines for earning bronze in the Boys Varsity 2X event at the 2018 Scholastic Rowing Association of America's National Championship Regatta. Rowing, by the way, is something that just about anybody can do with a good coach. You do not have to be sighted. Along with his teammate, Sam Kupinchabar, Chase took home second national medal for their club, the Burnt Hills Rowing Association, has ever won. In addition to the Nationals, Chase and Sam won the New York State Scholastic Rowing Championship last May, and he earned 21 medals in local, state, national, and international races during his racing career. That's pretty good. That's pretty good. Well, we have run out of time for today's episode of Sports Illustrated Kids. We hope that you have enjoyed it. Be sure to tune in every Thursday at 10 o'clock p.m. This program is rebroadcast, as noted, in the TRRS program guide and is readily available as a podcast at our website, www.triangleadingservice.org. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. If you have any comments or questions, please call TRRS at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.